If you listen closely between the hisses and pops in this recording of Bach's Toccata and Fugue, you can hear Albert Schweitzer warbling through the piece on an instrument that seemed ancient even at that time, the pipe organ. The record was made in 1935 when recording technology was improving rapidly, and even though many of us might hear something more like antiquated Halloween music in this track, Paul Eli hears innovation and evolution. His latest book makes the case that Bach is so renowned today, not just because of his compositional skills, but because musicians, maestros, and academics have expressly set out to reframe and reinvent his music for each new generation. Reinventing Bach is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Paul Eli back to our show today. Hello.
Hi there, I'm pleased to be back.
You've said that Bach provides a pattern of invention in his music, and that makes it possible to be adventurous in recording it while Bach always remains Bach. Haven't musicians and even composers been attempting to figure out how he was able to do that for years now?
Really, that's been the question that people have tried to ask. Some people would say since his death. Other people would say since the middle of the 19th century when something like a Bach revival began. There's so much music of Bach. It's all extraordinary. It can be played in so many different ways and seems to retain the character of Bach. It's hard to comprehend just how he did it.
Well, Mozart and Beethoven were pretty great, and I can name a whole bunch of other composers, but we don't see something similar with them.
Mozart died young. Beethoven, hearing loss and so forth. But the fact that the two of them looked to Bach as the greatest of them all, one a composer they could not surpass, says a lot about his stature even then.
Well, he was popular and a gainfully employed musician in his day, but then he fell into relative obscurity. Why?
Well, again, scholars have asked why that happened and whether it happened to the extent that it's commonly thought. Bach, for a man who had a great sense of his role and a great sense of posterity, oddly left no will. He left all his music to a couple of sons who scattered it in different directions. It took about 100 years to put the pieces back together again. So that's an obvious explanation. Another is that although he was a very busy working musician, he was outside of the big towns. You know, Handel went to London and made a career there. Bach stayed in a part of Germany that was not at the center of things.
And he was famous as a great musician, less so as a composer, or was it simply because, at least as the traditional story about the Goldberg variations, they were too difficult for musicians of his time to play. So was it the Goldbergs? Anyway, he wrote a number of things that probably would have really taxed most of the musicians of his time.
That's right. So let's figure that at least half of his music is church music, cantatas, passions, the Mass in B minor. So that promotes a certain idea of Bach as a church musician. There's all this instrumental work, struggling in a sense to get out from under the church music, and the most representative pieces are also extraordinarily difficult to play. So to play the cello suites correctly, you've got to be a virtuoso like Pablo Casals. Likewise, the Goldberg variations, the violin sonatas and partitas, and so on. So it took some effort for people to grab that music and make it their own.
But then, as you pointed out, he kind of was revived in the last half of the 19th century. Mendelssohn is given some credit for that. Did it take a composer to recognize how great a composer Bach had been?
It took a composer, and a young composer who had the energy to get together the forces for a St. Matthew Passion. They used over 100 singers at that time, and they rehearsed for weeks and weeks. Large orchestra, many singers, many parts. It was quite an enterprise. Then there was a technical or mechanical aspect to this. At that time, if you had as much music as Bach did, how were you going to distribute it so that musicians would know how to play it? It needed to be widely reproduced. So some scholars and Bach lovers got together and produced a Bach edition that started making the rounds in the latter part of the 19th century. Suddenly the music was in print, and then it could be distributed, learned, and played.
Paul Eli's latest book is Reinventing Bach. It is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. There are a few times in the book when you point out that you're not a musician. So what got you interested in writing about such an exhaustive and musically specific topic?
Well, I'm not a classical musician. I play saxophone and electric guitar. And so I grew up with a lot of music in the house, just not the music of Bach. And then it was through the radio, really, that I was converted to Bach. The Columbia University radio station has an annual Bach Fest each December.
WKCR.
Yes, that's right. Most of the year, these extraordinary jazz specials, and then for 10 days, the airwaves are given over to Bach. Well, I left the radio on and inadvertently had a life-changing encounter with the music of Bach. I heard this music. It was the most extraordinary music I'd heard, and it didn't go off for over a week. You could go to sleep, and Bach was on, and wake up, and it's still there. You could leave your radio on for the organ music on the overnight. You'd go onto the street and go into a cafe, and they'd have it on playing in the cafe. And the sense that was communicated was not only of the greatness of Bach, but the superabundance of Bach, that it's elemental, like earth and air. It's there, and it's inexhaustible. I fell hard, and I still haven't gotten over it.
Well, some people have compared him to Shakespeare because Shakespeare invented part of the English language, and Bach seems to have invented a way of approaching music that we've adopted ever since.
That's right. A lot of people would put him right at the beginning, the way, say, Harold Bloom characterized Shakespeare as the inventor of the human. The difference with Bach is that we know more about Bach, at least the particulars of his life, than we do about Shakespeare's, and also that for us English speakers, because he's a German and German language composer, he's something of an enigma to us, and we're able to approach the music sonically without having to grasp the particular lines of the Bible that are being quoted, for example.
Is that why this book is part biography, despite the fact that it's really about the way Bach has come to be reinvented over the many decades?
That's right. I tried to strand Bach's story through the book, and I did that for a couple of reasons. One is that to get a hold of Bach, you have to get a hold of who you think he was. That's true for Pablo Casals, that's true for Glenn Gould, and that's true for an author. So if I'm going to apprehend Bach's story, I might as well do it in my own medium, which is prose. Then at the same time, I don't think the story of Bach has been told the way, in such a way as to bring him fully forward. It's very difficult because of the level of scholarship to tell his story so that it moves along, and I tried to do that.
You open your book by recounting a visit to Berlin's Musikinstrumentenmuseum, where you saw a harpsichord that had been owned by Bach. You seemed interested in it, but most of the museum's other patrons were drawn to something quite different.
That's right. I don't know how the people there picked me out as another American. I was silently staring in a kind of awe at this harpsichord that had been owned by Bach, looking at the keys. They're the color of eggshell, or eggplant rather, and they're worn down, and thinking, wow, Bach touched those keys, and that ware that I'm looking at is from his own hands. And a guy from across the museum hollers, "Hey, they've got the real synthesizer here that Pink Floyd used on Wish You Were Here." So after a while, I went over, and there it is, and I had a moment where I realized that although I know Bach's music extraordinarily well at this point as a listener, I've never heard Bach play it. It's all at several centuries removed, played by other musicians. That synthesizer made a certain sound that I've heard on a record 100 times. And that gap between different kinds of experience of music is something that I've been trying to dramatize for several years in writing the book.
Now, Bach is a giant, but obviously all art comes out of art. And he was somebody who was interested in hearing the great music of his day. You recount a story about where he traveled 300 miles on foot. 300 miles on foot?
It's hard to believe.
Just to hear the greatest living organist of his time, Dietrich Buxtehude. What does that story reveal to you about Bach?
Well, it reveals a couple of things. One is that although he's usually characterized as the greatest product of a musical family, he probably was head and shoulders above some of his relatives. He had to go out of the family to hear an extraordinary musician, and that's why he took that long journey.
Because his father played organ, didn't he?
His father was a trumpeter, but they all played a number of instruments. He had an uncle who was an important organist. Musicians all over the region, basically if you were an adult male Bach, when you reached a certain age, you took a musical position at a church or court.
You say that recent scholarship contradicts the notion that Bach's compositions depended on the places he lived and the positions he held. You mean that his composing wasn't influenced by his professional status?
No. The common approach to Bach's life is to break his life into periods according to where he worked. So for a while he's working for a prince at court. Then he gets a job as the director of music for two churches in Leipzig. And it's commonly said that, well, he was working for the prince, he was writing this secular instrumental works, and then once he went to church, service of the church in Leipzig, he began writing mainly sacred works. But recent scholarship has suggested that that's not really the case, that he wrote the Goldberg Variations, say, at the same time that he was writing some remarkable sacred works.
So it was really just where his musical mind was at any given time.
He had all kinds of music going on several tracks, and he was working it out as time allowed.
Do we see a development over the years? Because to me, when I hear anything by Bach, I know right away it's by Bach, and in the same way that anything by Mozart is immediately Mozartian. But I'd assume that over the years he developed new ideas and perhaps got more complex in his thinking.
There's some development, and especially at the end of his life, scholars see a development towards a kind of musical abstraction that isn't strongly represented earlier in his career. But there's very powerful counterexamples. His best-known work to Americans, the Goldberg Variations, an exuberant work. Recent scholarship says that shortly after he finished that work, he began writing The Art of the Fugue, a work usually characterized as cool and abstract, as a late work that ponders death. These two works, he was working on part of them in the same year.
Paul Elie, E-L-I-E, his book Reinventing Bach is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Paul Elie, who is the author of The Life You Save May Be Your Own, which was awarded the Penn Martha Albrand Award for First Nonfiction, among other prizes. He was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award in Biography. His latest is Reinventing Bach. It is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. We went into that break with Glenn Gould recording from 1955, the first time he approached the Goldberg Variations. He later recorded them in a totally different approach. And we just heard a piece of a part of Switched on Bach by then Walter Carlos, now Wendy Carlos. That was on a synthesizer and became a big hit. So these are perfect examples of the kind of thing you're talking about in this book, how Bach has been invented and reinvented again and again. But in the end, it's always Bach. When we hear that that recording on the synthesizer, we still know it's Bach, don't we?
I think so. And certainly the people who made those recordings didn't want their own presence to get in the way of Bach. Glenn Gould, he was an early adopter. He had an early reel-to-reel tape recorder when he was a teenager. So he developed his own practice of making recordings, doing the pieces out of order, doing multiple takes until he got it just the way he wanted, moving the microphones around. So when he got a record deal with Columbia and came to New York to a state-of-the-art recording studio, he brought his own approach. And he recorded the Goldberg Variations in June of 55. The famous aria that begins the piece, he recorded last, and he used 20 takes to remove all the extra expression from it so that it would feel neutral. And then the 21st take is the one that begins the recording.
Is that why they were seen as a revelation? Because he emphasized the clarity of the music, whereas the style of the day was almost to play Bach as a romantic composer?
I think that's right. The clarity, the speed, the swing of it and the compactness of it. His record is less than 40 minutes. It worked out to be just perfect for an LP. The Goldberg Variations takes 40 minutes the way he plays it, and it splits in the middle, and so does an LP.
You say that Bach was technologically the most advanced musician of his era. Was it common for musicians to also serve as technicians and repairmen of their own instruments?
If you were an organist, you had to know how the organ worked and how it was put together. It wasn't so common for a musician of Bach's caliber to also be the expert for his whole region on the repair and restoration of organs. Much of what we know about Bach, his everyday dealings, has to do with the fact that in churches, there are ledger books that record the visit of Bach to inspect or repair or play the first recital on an organ, and he was paid such and such, and it's in the record books, and that's how we know what he did that Sunday.
But he was playing on these huge organs with lots of pipes in churches. He wasn't playing on anything like the kinds of organs we often see today, the Hammond B-37, for example, which is commonly used by jazz and rock musicians.
That's right. It's not as compact as the Hammond organ, but his organs were smaller than the organs, let's say the organs you see in large New York churches. And a lot of the reinvention of Bach organ music has had to do with the fact that people say, look, use a smaller organ, it sounds better.
And when we listen to the well-tempered clavier, we're not hearing the music that Bach played, are we? We're hearing it on modern pianos. Wouldn't it be quite different?
Well, the piano in some form existed late in Bach's life. And when Bach went to visit the King of Prussia, the King of Prussia had lots of this relatively new instrument, the fortepiano. And he took Bach around, and Bach probably played the best thing that had ever been heard on the piano. So it's not really a violation of Bach to play his music on the piano. It develops a theme that he started late in life.
Part of your book focuses on the way that inventions like the long-playing record, headphones, portable listening devices have placed Bach's music into new contexts. Where did most people find his music before they could hear it at home? Was it just in concert halls and churches?
A lot of the music was in churches, and you would go to church, and if you were favored at your church with a particularly good orchestra or soloist, you would have a better experience of the music. Same goes for an organist. Then, around the turn of the century, the piano became a staple of the middle-class parlor. So the symbol that you'd arrive to the middle class was you had a piano in your house, and on the piano you had a music stand with certain key pieces, such as Jesu Joy of Man's Desiring by Bach. So many people heard the music that way. Then joining the piano in the parlor was the phonograph and the radio, and once those were combined into a single unit, the age of recordings, as I call it, was really set in gear.
And recordings changed the way many people understood Bach. For example, Pablo Casals' recordings of his solo pieces for cello, which had mostly been exercises for students, and suddenly we hear Pablo Casals' versions and realize that these are among the most profound pieces ever composed.
That's right. I think to hear them before Pablo Casals' recordings, if you wanted to hear the cello suite, you had to be a cellist or employ a cellist or be married to a cellist. And to be present with a cellist is to realize the exertion that goes into the playing of them. Suddenly you have a record that you can play in your home, and a lot of the effort isn't apparent, and the beauty becomes more apparent.
Well, did other cellists understand that these were profound pieces, or did it take Pablo Casals to understand that and then record it and share it?
It's still thought that Casals was the one who grasped that they were sublime, profound music and not exercises. There was one other cellist, Feuermann, who wanted to record them in the 30s, but Casals was the major artist for the label, so he had pride of place.
In recent years, we've seen growing popularity of older instruments and whole orchestras form playing the kind of instruments from the time of Bach or other times around in the 17th, 18th century. A caller wonders about the role of the Polish harpsichordist Wanda Landowska in reviving Bach's music.
She was a crucial figure. She played the harpsichord. She had a big custom-made harpsichord and played it with great power and conveyed the power of the music and also the delicacy that you can get on a harpsichord. She came to America with her custom harpsichord, set herself up in Connecticut, and was a living example of an old world tradition that had now taken root here in North America, and so was very important to people who followed, like Rosalind Turek or Glenn Gould.
Mm-hmm. And was her interpretation tied to the fact she was playing it on a harpsichord? Would it have sounded very different? I'm not just talking about the sound of the instrument, but the interpretation if she were playing on a piano?
Well, the piano offers a greater variety of sounds, and the harpsichord, you might say, offers a greater intensity of certain sounds. To hear her harpsichord performances, they're very focused and intense, and you realize as a listener today you're used to a great deal of variety from piece to piece, and she doesn't variety's not a card she's playing. She's working with intensity instead.
Now, we mentioned that the advent of the long playing record was important. Earlier, these pieces had to be on 12-inch discs, 78 discs, and you had to have a record changer, and one would plop down after another. The fidelity suddenly changed as well, and people started buying these really fancy home hi-fi systems. Is that tied to the way we have come to understand Bach?
It definitely is, and in so many ways that it took several hundred pages of the book to really lay it all out. When you have suddenly a long-playing record, you can hear a work that takes a couple of hours, like the Well-Tempered Clavier, in a single listening session without the exertion or the commitment that going to the concert hall would require. Some people say, well, that's horrible. That reduces it to a kind of background music. But on the other hand, you can get familiar with the music in a way that might not have been possible if you were a musician. You can hear it dozens of times.
A lot of musicians, rock musicians, have been upset by these download sites that you get on the internet, the Napster, for example. Do you think it's affecting the way we understand Bach's music today?
I think it's a very different effect than we're seeing in pop music. Classical people have become late adopters in the technological era. It's hard to remember that that wasn't always the case. In the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, each new technological development in music, such as the LP or stereo, was marketed to the classical people first. Around the time of the Walkman and then especially the iPod and iPhone, those products were marketed at pop music people and young people first. So classical people, having been late to the party of downloads and free streaming music, in a way have insulated classical culture from some of the commercial effects of those technologies.
Well, whether or not technology has helped or hurt musicians in the long run, you make a good case for the impact that other musicians have had on Bach's legacy. And that part of your story begins with Albert Schweitzer. Why him? I always think of him as the doctor in Africa. I know, who played organ on the side.
Right. He's known as a medical missionary. He's known for important work about the study of the historical Jesus. But he's also known for these recordings of Bach, especially. You mentioned it as Halloween music, and every Halloween on Clinton Avenue in Brooklyn, I still hear the coming out from an old manse that's done up with spider webs and supposedly cracked glass. You hear this music, the Toccata and Fugue in D minor in Schweitzer's recording. To me, his recording made in 35 enters into the record the long experience of the music of Bach that preceded the era in which everybody made recordings. So in that sense, he's a link to the long pre-recorded past of Bach.
Well, we mentioned earlier that Mendelssohn revived him, but then he went out of fashion with some composers. Wagner thought he was kind of antiquated, didn't he?
It's hard to say. He's on record saying all sorts of things about Bach, but definitely in Die Meistersinger, there's gestures toward Bach in all sorts of directions. And Schweitzer saw Bach and Wagner having more in common than the people in between. And that's a crucial argument to his two-volume book on Bach that came out around 1910.
Casals and Schweitzer were among the first musicians to make recordings of Bach's music that would then go on to become representative of those pieces of music. So then when other musicians came along, did they then have to find a way to personalize them?
That's right. Before those records, people came to the music through the sheet music, through their teacher, through the particular instrument they were playing, through local culture. Suddenly you had a recording, and most cellists after Casals had heard Casals recordings and have to think about a way to do it just a little bit differently. By the time of Glenn Gould, you had a musician who had come of age in the age of recordings and had learned as much from recordings as he had from study or practice or his teachers.
How did the Toccata and Fugue become pop music? Because it has. I mean, every time there was a movie, Captain Nemo being a mysterious character, he's at the organ, he's playing Toccata and Fugue. We get it in Fantasia, Disney's Fantasia.
Right. So that's one answer to the question right there. It was distributed widely. It was in one of the best-known movies by one of the best-known directors, Walt Disney. It's the opening sequence to Fantasia as orchestrated by Stokowski. It was released on the most powerful record label of the time, EMI in England and Columbia over here. So that music was kept in the catalog, redistributed on each new format, and so it is that this 1935 recording is still available on iTunes.
Now, we mentioned earlier that Glenn Gould recorded the Goldberg Variations twice. We heard an example from the first recordings. Why did he feel it necessary to go back and record them again?
All sorts of reasons came together in about 1980 for Gould. The record that he had become famous for sounded antique to him. It was recorded in mono. He was struggling with hand problems and wanted to get back to a work that he knew well, so that was the Goldberg Variations. He'd never been filmed playing it, and there was a director who wanted to get him on film. And then, and to me this was decisive, the studio where he'd first recorded the Goldberg Variations at 30th, between 2nd and 3rd, Manhattan, was about to be destroyed. So he had a chance to go back to that room where he'd first made a great record and do it all over again, and so he jumped at the chance to do that.
And do you hear a big difference between the first and second approaches?
There are all sorts of differences. The sound is clearer and more spacious. Some of the variations are played more slowly. He takes some of the repeats, which he didn't do in the first, and because he died at age 50 shortly after the record was released, it's hard to hear, not to hear that in the recording and to hear it as an example of musical lateness.
Paul Eli's book, Reinventing Bach, by the way, Eli spelled E-L-I-E, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being on our show today. It's been fascinating.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
And my only regret is we didn't play more music.